Last Sunday, we had our joyful annual celebration of the blessing of the animals. And it is one of my favorite Sundays here. Last Sunday was also the first Sunday after the tragic shooting at Umpqua Community College last Thursday. And while we observed a moment, I did mention that that would be the topic of my sermon this Sunday, and it is. This week, as Thursday approached, I had very mixed feelings and was thinking, well, maybe the moment has passed. Then on Friday, campus shootings in Texas and Arizona, and the recollection last week of an 11-year-old who shot his 8-year-old neighbor. And those are just a couple things in the U.S. There was the U.S. military bombing of a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, and only yesterday, the double bombing at a peace rally in Ankara, Turkey, which left at least 100 dead. The moment has not passed because our world is profoundly disordered. I almost never do this, but this Sunday I am going to provide several disclaimers for my sermon. The first one is this: I generally believe I have pretty well-ordered thoughts before I get up here. Things happen, but I think I have generally well-ordered thoughts. But my emotions around this continue to churn, so it is difficult in some ways to know exactly what I can say, what I can muster is not necessarily entirely clear to me. So there will come a point that I will probably be sharing the pulpit with Kimberly, with whom I've discussed this topic at length. So that's the first disclaimer. My thoughts may not be as clear as I would hope. Today, I share my pastoral perspective, knowing that first, there are some here, if not many here, that will disagree with my perspective. And there are still others who will feel that I am inappropriately mixing politics and religion in the pulpit. I am also aware that speaking directly about this, some will take offense and will be disturbed because they want this a sacred time and space of retreat and respite from the stresses outside. So those are the disclaimers. I can live with that tension and disagreement. And I sincerely hope if you have that disagreement, you come to me directly. So hear me. If you disagree with me, tell me, and not a dozen other people first. Amen. That has never happened to anyone, has it? So let this be your first opportunity to practice. So as a pastor, I can live with and love those with whom I disagree, but I cannot live as a pastor. I cannot live with not speaking and you not knowing my moral discernment and conscience on this matter that is of grave importance in our world. That I cannot live with. So, disclaimers aside, I ask you to pray with me. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be a delight in your sight, God, you who are our rock, our strength, and our redeemer. Amen. I remember above the fireplace in my childhood home was a mounted deer head. And it is exactly as you imagine it in your mind. On a wooden plaque with its neck erect, the head slightly turned, the rack of antlers borne proudly aloft. dark brown glass eyes eternally open and staring into the distance. It was kind of emblematic of the rural Western Pennsylvania life and the hunting culture in which I was raised. In that area of Pennsylvania, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, you do the math. Game hunting was ubiquitous, particularly deer hunting. Now, I remember in middle school and high school, on the first day of deer season, you could anticipate one of the lowest attendances of the entire year. It was just true. You just knew to anticipate lots were not going to be in school when deer hunting season opened. And during hunting season, it was not uncommon for some of my classmates to come to school with their rifles, because they had been hunting before school or were going to be going on hunting trips with friends and family. That was not uncommon in my middle school and high school experience. Not only do I come from a family and a culture of hunters, I have a father who was a World War II veteran, and my uncle, his brother, a career military sergeant. So on one hand, I have some personal familiarity with those who have owned and used guns in what I perceive to be legal and responsible ways. On the other hand, however, I have never shot a firearm myself. All of my life, I have never had any interest in doing so. I have always found, personally, the notion of hunting animals for sport distasteful and repellent. It's kind of how I feel about football. You're welcome to disagree with me, but you know, that is where I stand. I don't get the attraction, and at this point, I never will. And if I'm allowed a third hand, I can imagine that if I needed to hunt and kill for food, or an even more troublesome scenario, if I needed to defend myself, or more importantly, protect someone that I loved from attack, I recognize that within myself, I likely do bear the capacity to use deadly force. I hope and pray that day never comes. So I say that to illustrate that our national debate, and indeed our very own experiences about gun violence, it's not simple. It is not black and white. It is complicated. And for people of faith, which we proclaim we are, it demands prayerful attention. We have heard, and we are hearing, and perhaps even most prominently from U.S. President Barack Obama, but voices across our nation are frustrated and calling out for action on this matter. Thoughts and prayers are one thing, but will we move beyond thoughts and prayers? It reminds me of the quote from that little letter in the New Testament named James, the letter of James in chapter 2. It says, "If a brother or sister is ill-clad and in lack of daily food, and you say to them, 'Go in peace, be warm and well-filled,' without giving them the things they need for the body, what does it profit? Faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead." So if we say, quote, "our thoughts and prayers are with them," and those words are not accompanied by actions that both comfort and work to prevent further fatal shootings, our faith is dead. Our thoughts and prayers are emptied of their meaning, and they become an insult added to the injury. In the wake of the shooting at Umpqua, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon issued a very brief statement, and in it they attached a document that I had never seen before. It had never crossed my attention. And it was a link to a statement from the National Council of Churches in the United States, a statement from 2010. Now, the National Council of Churches in the United States is a network of 37 Christian denominations, more than 100,000 congregations, more than 45 million Christians in the U.S. are members of congregations and denominations in the U.S. National Council of Churches. I printed out a number of these statements. They're found on the table in the fireside room. And I found it exceedingly good, exceedingly compelling. And I want to read just a few sentences from a little portion on their Christian call in response. It is difficult to imagine that the one whose own passion models the redemptive power of nonviolence would look favorably on the violence of contemporary U.S. society. Present-day violence is made far worse than it otherwise would be by the prevalence of weapons in our streets. Christian tradition insists that it is idolatry to trust in guns to make us secure. Idolatry is a strong word. Since that leads to mutual escalation while distracting from the one whose love alone gives security. And then further, Christians can contend that it is necessary for public authority to take up arms to protect citizens, but to allow assault weapons in the hands of the general public can scarcely be justified on Christian grounds. The reality is, such weapons end up taking more lives than they defend, and the reckless sale of these weapons refutes the gospel's prohibition against violence. And I will add, I believe the one who, at his arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane, counseled his followers, one of his followers who struck out in defense of Jesus, said, "Those who take up the sword will die by the sword." I cannot imagine that one would look favorably upon Christians being given discounts for the purchase of firearms. If you heard that on the news. The excerpt that we heard from Micah, from the ancient prophet Micah, it's actually a nearly direct and exact quote from the ancient prophet Isaiah. And it offers perhaps a familiar image, a future promise, still future promise, but it is through the prophet's eyes a glimpse of the world as God would want it to be. Nation shall not take up sword against nation. People will beat their swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks. Weapons of violence and death are transformed into tools that cultivate life. Now, swords and spears are no longer the weapons of choice in our culture about which we most grieve. It is guns. The question before us is, will we, through inaction, cultivate a culture of death, or will we actively cultivate a culture of life? How long will we tolerate living in a world that remains so distant from God's dream for our world? And this is the moment that I'd invite a couple of moments from Kimberly, who has a unique perspective, I believe. Thanks.
I've been working in my life on the word hate. You know, I use it so easily on things that happen. I hate it when I have to run across the street and there's traffic. Man, I hate it when she looks at me that way. And I've been really practicing not to say the word hate because all of a sudden it's really meant something to me. I don't know why it took me 50 years to figure out it really wasn't a good word, but I hate guns. I hate guns. I have no rational thinking around the word guns. I can't barely talk to my partner and my beloved about guns because she loves to target shoot. And we have guns in our house, which I hate in my house. It makes me so angry. You see, I was shot at when I was 10 and a half because I happened to live in a country that was at war. I had to go to school in bulletproof cars so that we might not be killed. My earliest memory is of the men with machine guns standing at the corner with bags of sand around them. I do not understand this culture we live in that loves guns, and I cannot be rational about it. And I do not believe that if we continue in this path, that we will ever, ever beat our weapons into sources that would provide food for our neighbors rather than kill our neighbors. Because you see, I believe it is in our very, very DNA in this American culture to carry a gun so that we can kill one another. Don't get me even, I can't even be rational about it. That is why we have guns in our house. It is to kill somebody. Don't talk to me about target practice. When you have a gun in your house and you say, I need it for defense, it means you have made an honest and conscious decision that you're going to kill somebody. 26 years ago, I told my partner, who I love beyond measure. I can't even tell you how much I love her. I will never kill somebody for you. She stayed with me. I will never kill somebody for you. I hate guns. Micah says we have to go to the mountain, to God's mountain, to listen to God, to learn God's ways. We have not gone to the mountain yet, so we cannot beat our weapons into plowshares to learn God's way. Because you see, what's got to happen, I think, is we've got to change our DNAs in this country. We can't be the cowboy walking down the street. We cannot go west, young man, and take back this country from the people who lived here honestly and with integrity. People are in their house arming themselves right now to defend themselves against what? Barack Obama has not taken a single gun from anybody. He has bombed a lot, but he's not taking your guns, and he's not gonna. Amen. Nor is the government going to. But don't tell me that you don't have a gun in your house because you're not willing to kill somebody. I gotta go to the mountain, though, because I can't even be rational with this. Talking to Nathan about this topic, I get myself all riled up. I'm talking to you about it. I'm riled up. Whoa! How do I change the DNA? I can't by myself. I gotta go to the mountain and listen to God. And right now, what God is saying to me, and I think maybe to all of us, is I gotta take Gail with me to a meeting and listen to her about why she likes to have guns in target practice. I gotta go and take that sheriff who I can barely think of, I don't wanna speak his name, from Roseburg, who says he will not enforce laws of this land if he believes they violate his right to bear arms. That's like Kim Davis, okay? You know, the person we all love to hate right now because she's not carrying out the laws of the land? That sheriff is the same way. But for the people who love guns, for the people who think gay marriage is an abomination, they're doing a great thing. I gotta sit down with Kim Davis, or the Kim Davis of Oregon right now, who is the sheriff in Roseburg. And I gotta listen to him. I gotta listen to the woman who decided to shoot a shoplifter in Home Depot this week. She was just helping. I gotta bring my client to the table who ran out of the AT&T phone store a couple of years ago with his gun to shoot at the shoplifters over telephones. And he doesn't understand why he was arrested. We can laugh at them, but until we listen to them, until we make space where we hear them and they hear us, I would ban every gun in this country. Military, police, that's how rabid radical I am about this issue. I would ban every gun. You gotta stop praying, you gotta keep praying, but we gotta stop sitting on our butts. And the only way to do that is to dialogue, because we gotta change our culture. It cannot be okay. Not to be okay. To think it's okay to kill another human being, for me, under any circumstance. Under any circumstance.
I'm going to add just a couple of concluding thoughts. Kimberly actually reminded me of another article I read from a pastor. Since I didn't prepare to credit this particular pastor, I can't remember, but I believe he may have been a Southern pastor. Doesn't matter. But the quote that sticks with me is, "Any decision that is made on fear is not a Christian decision. Any decision based in fear is not a Christian response." One of the most moving and troubling responses to last Thursday's shooting was written by Melissa Duclo. I presume that's how her name is pronounced. She was on her second day teaching at another Oregon community college on the day of the shooting at Umpqua, her second day as a community college instructor. And she wrote an open letter in response to that shooting. And it begins by her describing how she read through the emergency response manual of her community college and how it instructs her what to do if they learn of a shooter, what to do if the shooter is in the building, what to do if the shooter comes into the room, written in the emergency response manual. Quote, "I'm told what to do if the shooter does in fact enter our classroom. There is no one procedure that can be recommended in this situation, the manual informs me with grim honesty before adding, if you must fight, fight to win and survive. Fight to survive. I am a teacher with a master's degree in creative writing, and this is part of my job. These security measures, generic, unfollowable, completely incompatible with the reality of my school, are, in their inadequate way, essential. It is not the school's fault that heavily armed people, whether through incurable rage or mental instability, all too frequently choose academic institutions as the settings for the horror they unleash. I recognize we do not have the resources to retrofit our facilities with safer features. I am positive that handing me or any teacher a gun will solve nothing. Regardless of the level of preparedness, though, it is clear that schools and teachers are being asked to do a job that they are not meant to do. My son will start kindergarten next year. At 5 years old, he and his classmates, in addition to learning reading and math, will be walked through lockdown drills by a teacher who will likely be hiding terror as she has students practice finding a cozy place to hide and times how long they can remain quiet. It will probably seem like a game to him at first, but eventually my son and the rest of America's school children who are learning the same lesson will ask why. Why have we allowed our schools to become a place where children must hide and teachers must fight to survive? What do you recommend I tell him? This week, when I speak to my students about what happened at Umpqua and about our own emergency procedures, what do you advise I say after I explain that the stapler and whiteboard markers, the only classroom supplies I have in my room, are critical to our survival?" Many of us in this room may not have children of our own, but we do have children right here, right now. The children who walk to the family room, who laugh and speak out during our worship service, who dance in front of our musicians and delight our hearts. Let's make it personal. When Radar goes to kindergarten, when Haley goes to kindergarten, will they be taught the same grim game to hide and play dead, to avoid being shot? If we are okay with that being part of kindergarten curriculum, if we're okay with that being just part of the world the way it is, if we're okay with that by our inaction saying it's okay, then it is not just the shooters who pull triggers who are disordered. We have become disordered. Can children silently cowering with teachers, can Bible study groups praying with pastors knowing that churches are not even exempt from gun violence, can the voice of the ancient prophet reach their ears, turn swords into plowshares and swords into pruning hooks? Can they believe that it was actually God who issued the other words, "No one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of God has spoken"? Our sincere thoughts and earnest prayers, even our broken hearts for the dead and wounded and traumatized and grieving, are necessary, but they are not enough if they do not lead us to a conviction to change the world that we have created.